You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Okay, well, first of all, I'll just say welcome to everyone. We're really excited to have such a great, diverse group. My name is Phoebe Schreiner, and I work with an international women's program here at OSI. Maybe I'll just say a few words about the International Women's Program. Beginning in 2007 and now 2008, we've started a new time for our program where we've launched some work on women in conflict and post-conflict societies. We have four main areas in which we're working, principally around justice, legal and judicial reform, rights protection, and empowerment. I must say that we're really inspired to host this event right now because, in fact, it's congruent with the annual Commission on the Status of Women, which is taking place at the United Nations just now. And we're really privileged to have so many excellent women's groups that are from the regions who are working on issues that we've just highlighted that are here, and we're really delighted to amplify their voices and share their experiences on the ground with you. So in that respect, I think I'd like to start and just share their bios, give you a little information about each one of them. First, we have Ruth Ojiambo Ocheng, is the executive director of ISIS Women's International Cross-Cultural Exchange, which is an organization based in Uganda that works internationally, in fact, that empowers women affected by armed conflicts. They document and advocate on women's rights violations in more than 50 countries and promote women's leadership in conflict resolution, peace building, and reconstruction processes. Ms. Ocheng played a critical role in lobbying for women's participation in peace talks between the government of Uganda and the Lord's Resistant Army for one of Africa's longest civil wars. Before she came to ISIS-WIKI, which is the acronym of her organization, in 1994, she was head of a documentation center at the Uganda Constituent Assembly Commission, and she managed the Attorney General's Library and the Ministry of Justice for 14 years. She served on Amnesty International's Committee for Movement Growth, the Advisory Committee for Women's Initiative for Gender Justice at The Hague, and the Advisory Committee for Women's Human Rights Defenders. Next, we have Mr. Gopal Krishna Siwakti,
yes, Siwakti.
Who is president of the International Institute for Human Rights, Environmental and Development Organization called INHURID, which is a partner of Population Watch in Nepal. In 2007, he worked as coordinator of the Peace Audit Program, monitoring the comprehensive peace across the country. From 1999 to 2006, he served as Secretary General of the Himalayan Human Rights Monitors. HIMRIGHTS currently serves as the Secretary General of the National Election Observation Committee and is National Advisor to the Alliance for Human Rights and Social Justice. He has been a convener and patron of Amnesty International, and has coordinated the 24-hour human rights lifeline on conflict monitoring and reporting, among other many other great accomplishments. Next, we have Ms. Marie-Claire Ruhamya, who is from the Democratic Republic of Congo and a founding member and spokesperson of the Solidarity of Women's Burhal. She's a founding member of the Foundation for Social and Cultural Cooperation of the Groups of African States, the Caribbean, and the Pacific, as well as the Council of African Communities of Europe and Belgium. She was also the special rapporteur of the Congolese diaspora during the DRC national consultation and is currently a member of the International Action Network on Small Arms. So let's really welcome our distinguished guests. And with that, I will pass it to Mr. Arye Nair, who needs no introduction, and who will say some additional welcoming words. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to see you here this afternoon to talk about a very important question, and that is the violence against women that is, in many circumstances, major factor in contemporary armed conflicts. I think I became aware of the issue of violence against women in armed conflicts through someone who is in the room this evening. After the war for the liberation of Bangladesh from Pakistan, Adrian Germain, who is the president of the International Women's Health Coalition, was the person who I think sort of introduced me to the issue, and there I was made aware of it in the context of a terrible problem after the conflict, and that is that very large numbers of women had been raped during the conflict, and thereafter they had difficulty because their fathers and husbands considered them to be unclean, and they were no longer welcome in the family home. So the tragedy of what happened to those women was exacerbated by the social condemnation of the victims of the violence. Coming sort of closer in time, the issue of violence against women in connection with armed conflict was a major factor in the war in Bosnia in the early 1990s. And in that instance, I had traveled frequently to Bosnia while the war was underway. And interviewed many victims of sexual violence in Bosnia and also in Croatia at that time. And one of the things that became clear to me in the interviews that I engaged in is that the sexual violence was quite a deliberate tactic of the combatants in that conflict, that it was very much part of the policy of ethnic cleansing that was underway, that terrorizing women and terrorizing families, but by the use of sexual violence was a significant part of the way in which people were forced to flee from Bosnia, and in that way the ethnic cleansing would succeed. One of the characteristics that one found in many of the cases of sexual violence is that it did not take place secretly and furtively. It took place very often in full public view of members of a community in order to increase the terrorist quality of the sexual violence. I think knowing something about sexual violence as an aspect of conflict in different parts of the world. It has seemed to me that it is especially significant to call attention to the problem, to stigmatize the forces that use sexual violence as a means of armed conflict, and to see to it that the violence is dealt with as a war crime, that the use of law as a means of punishing those who engage in sexual violence seems to me to be absolutely critical, and it's part of the process of stigmatizing the forces that engage in sexual violence. Unfortunately, this seems to be a global problem. It happened in Asia, in Bangladesh. It happened in Europe, in Bosnia. It has happened as well in a country such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in Africa. There doesn't seem to be a part of the world that is exempt from the use of sexual violence. If one thinks back to World War II, it was also a practice during World War II. The Russian forces that liberated Eastern Europe were not very popular in Eastern Europe because of their extensive use of sexual violence, but it wasn't only the Russians. The French in Italy deliberately encouraged Moroccan troops to engage in sexual violence. And if any of you remember the film that was made with Sophia Loren called Two Women, based on a novel by Alberto Moravia, it is the story of that deliberately incited sexual violence that took place in Italy during World War II. I should say, however, that at Nuremberg, sexual violence was ignored. Prosecutors at Nuremberg referred to it vaguely and said these details are too horrible to go into, so they didn't go into them. And so there wasn't the kind of stigmatization of sexual violence that was necessary at that time. It was a little bit better than that at the Tokyo Tribunal after World War II, when the prosecutors did go into the rape of Nanking, the orgy of rape by Japanese soldiers in China during World War II. But it became a significant issue at the time of the establishment of the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, and women's groups in particular lobbied with the Office of the Prosecutor to make sure that sexual violence would be prosecuted in connection with the crimes that took place in Bosnia and in Croatia. And I think that had a very valuable effect. At any rate, there's a great deal more that has been learned in different parts of the world about this problem. And I think we have still a lot more to learn about how to address the problem. We haven't, I think, arrived at a full-fledged strategy as yet in dealing with this issue. So I expect the discussion this afternoon will help us in that respect. You have biographical information on the participants. They've been introduced to you already, so I'm going to call on them now without giving you any further biographical information on them. And the first speaker is Ruth Ojiambo Ochieng.
Can I use that?
By all means.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. President, the staff of Open Source Institute.
Can everybody hear in the back?
Yeah, can you?
Okay.
Open Society Institute, my fellow panelists, ladies and gentlemen. You know, when the president started talking, my mind went back into the villages that I visit all over Africa. And sometimes one needs to calm down first to be able to compose herself and talk, because immediately you start tracking what you have heard and what you have seen, and it doesn't become very easy. But I want to thank Open Society very much for having seen the issue of women and conflict as a very, very critical issue. Because for many years, many institutions, many donors have decided to push it under the carpet. Most cases because they say it is too hurting, as you have said. I only have 10 minutes, and I'm supposed to talk about the story of 10 years of the conflict that I have worked with, and I will really try to go very fast. Probably some of the issues that I will not talk about will come into the questions. I first want to start with my own life. I'm now in the middle of my life, evening of my life, and I have only lived conflict. I have not seen anything very interesting. My country has been in conflict since 1966, but in most cases you find that these are some of the ignored wars. So I'm one person who has lived conflict, and I'm still living conflict. So that is the kind of nature. And this pushed me to say, if I'm still living, then I must do something. And that is the time when ISIS Wiki came to Africa. And probably I should say what ISIS Wiki is. ISIS is an Egyptian goddess, a goddess who led her followers equally, both men and women. And she did not want to see any conflict. She wanted mutual respect between men and women. So my organization, which is Women's International Cross-Cultural Exchange, actually wants to emulate ISIS, the goddess, so that we can live in a world which is peaceful, where there is equality, and where we all enjoy it. But unfortunately, that is not what is happening. We were formed in Geneva, Switzerland, by only three women who are documentalists, who decided they must break the isolation of women. And women of the world must connect so that they can share experiences, knowledge, and be able to strategize together. And in 1974, that's when women were preparing to go to the first UN Mexico conference and were asking, what should I take there? They didn't know much, but they did some little research and thought women were isolated. And reaching Mexico, they found that was the issue. So from that time, our core purpose has been to generate knowledge, to tap the voices of women so that they are able to bring their concerns to international platforms like the ones here. In 1993, it decided to move its secretariat from Europe to Africa, because European women had at least got a certain level of communicating and sharing and, you know, engaging the status quo to say there is violation here, there is inequality here. And they decided to bring it to Uganda, mainly because my president was one of those at that time who had started showing some interest in seeing that there is empowerment of women. And there were very many women's organizations that were actually dealing with many issues of empowerment of women. But there was one aspect that none of them had actually decided to engage in, and that was the issue of women in situations of conflict. So when ISIS Wiki went into Uganda with a mandate to work all over the world, we decided that we are not going to go anywhere else when at home is we are in conflict. So we went out to tap the voices of women, and it wasn't easy. Most of the women in the women's movement decided to say, why are you causing all that? Women have forgotten. Please, they can't remember. But to our surprise, when we went in to document their voices, it was as if it happened yesterday. Women's voices had become battlegrounds. Women were looking for somebody to tell the story. And after telling the story, they would say, I now feel a bit better. But the thing that caused us really move on and say, it's not only documentation. The documentation must be action-oriented so that these women can see a transformed life to themselves. Is that their complications were very disturbing. We as social scientists did not know what they were talking about. The president talked about sexual violences. It was not only the raping. I mean, you are raped and your whole reproductive organ is stabbed. The humiliation of making women sleep with their children, opening up the bellies of women to see whether the child in the stomach is a boy or a girl. So all those made us realize that ISIS Week cannot work by itself. We needed to strategically get other partners who will come in and at least address those concerns of women. We found very many of them who had prolapse of the uteruses, many of them who had vagina fistulas. And for the last 14 years of the war, nobody had actually addressed this. So we went to the medical professionals and told them, you must do something. And that was the beginning of our networking with strategic partners like them to make change, whereby every time we document, we want an action-oriented emergency intervention to the sexual and reproductive complications that women get during the violation. Other than that, we did not want to continue being the people who are mourning and crying, but we needed to get the women themselves, the survivors, to stand up and actually engage. So it was critical that other than documenting, causing the intervention, it was important for us to build their capacities in understanding what is conflict, how to manage it, and their roles as women in making sure that they can mitigate the conflict. And we are very excited to see that these women picked up and went back into their villages, formed the community-based organizations, and they are replicating all these concerns. That success made us move to the Great Lakes region, and we did the same thing with the women networks. We don't open offices all over the world, but we work through networks. And presently, we are now in Liberia doing the same documentation. But probably before I stop, I know my time is almost over, is that let's look at what survivors of war have done in Uganda on the issue of the Juba peace process. Initially, the government of Uganda did not include the women. So what we did was to form a coalition, and we call ourselves the Uganda Women Coalition for Peace. And we went and engaged them, say, where are the women? And to our surprise, we realized that the men actually don't know that women are part and parcel of the peace process. And the Minister of Internal Affairs told us, oh, but this is about security. And it is about the ministers. You can see there is an internal affairs, there is security. So for us, it enabled us to understand the mind of the men. Conflict resolution is about the security and the power that they want to share. So what we did was to tell them that, yeah, that is your security, but we have the human security. That must be integrated into what you are doing if we have to have sustainable peace. I will conclude by saying Yes, we've pushed on. It has not been very easy. We've pushed the government of Uganda to put some women on their side of the table. We've gone and discussed it with the LRLs. They have also put the women there. But it is still very difficult. And it is difficult because of one key issue. The issues women peace activists are raising are more to do with the transformation of communities and making people gain their dignity and self-esteem. Whereas the men is about, I must still sustain my power to be powerful over the others. So I think open society could do a wonderful, wonderful support of women if you could engage government of Uganda to make sure that when they look at the peace process and what we want to come out of peace process, to see to it that the women also participate in the post-conflict rehabilitation. We are very worried about the DDR process. They have already started it. They are not caring about the mind, soul, and body of human beings. They are only reconstructing where they are going to pass their vehicles to go and get the votes. They are only reconstructing the small hospitals, which don't even have malaria tablets. But when you go there, they will show you, oh, Mr. President, here is a clinic. But we know very well those clinics don't have anything. I think I'll rest my case now and just wait for questions. Thank you very much.
Next speaker is Dr. Gopal Krishna Siwakoti.
Thank you, Chairperson. Fellow panelists, distinguished participants of this session, very good evening. It's my both honor and privilege to be invited here to speak about this conflict and the current painful transition that the country is going on, and to share some of the first-hand, time-tested, field-tested experience regarding the conflict and its implication to women. As you might know through the brief bio that I represent a tiny Himalayan country, Nepal, which has undergone a decade-long high-voltage internal armed conflict. And officially the conflict has been over after the signing of the peace agreement between the then rebel groups called Communist Party of Nepal, Maoist, and the government. However, the transit is so painful that even today the armed conflict in various forms is going on. So we do not wish to call it that the war is over, but the residue of violence are so much organized and so many splinter groups have emerged. So I think there is a long way to go, you know, to formally end the our internal armed conflict. I'd just like to go back to 1995 during the Beijing conference. When we were in Beijing conference, then the participants in the Beijing conference came out with 12 critical areas of concern, and one of them was women in conflict. And the Nepalese participants were a bit amazed to see that particular component, and we said, like, what are they talking about? That was in 1995. And in Beijing Plus 5, we started realizing that, oh, they are talking about something very important. And in Beijing Plus 10, the country was already engulfed in war. So it became the number one issue out of 12 critical areas of concern. So it is still, women in conflict is still the number one issue in Nepal in terms of the priority of 12 critical areas of concern. The conflict, which lasted for 10 years plus, has resulted in a catastrophic sort of situation for all women and men and children and all citizens of the country. And four areas that we have identified as the most critical issues are the forced displacement. Displacement in the form of IDPs, internally displaced persons, and also as refugees, because between 1 to 1.2 million people have crossed the international border during the conflict, particularly to India. And so women and even children have crossed the border as unsafe migrants, as irregular migrants outside the country. And they have ended up, most of them are ended up in involving themselves in 3D, which is popularly known as 3Ds, dirty, difficult, and dangerous work. So even today, many women and even children have been to India and Gulf countries, as well as in Southeast Asian countries, as unsafe and irregular international migrant workers. And that is particularly because of the conflict and the precarious economic situation in the country. And another issue is the trafficking in women and children, mostly to India, and now also in some other countries. That has been very much increased because of the conflict. As you already know, that in the stream of unsafe migration, the trafficking takes place. It's like fishing out in the flood of migration. So every year, according to the ILO statistics, between 10,000 to 12,000 women and children have been trafficked outside the country. So that number has really heightened, particularly during the wartime and even afterwards. And now it is also a question, a very much prominent question with regards to the double jeopardy to a certain section of women in the country, categorically Dalit, the indigenous women, and Madhesi women. Madhesi is a southern stretch, southern belt of Nepal, which has been under state discrimination and repression for centuries. Now a renewed set of violence has been taking place in the southern belt of the country. But everything is not dark. There are some bright sides also in the women's movement and in the post-conflict situation. And even during the conflict, so many non-conventional and new things have happened. There is a growing recognition to women's work. Women have been now seen and heard and identified and even consulted much in a greater scale than before. And that is, I think, is one of the outcome. Of course, war is always bad, but it has always some kind of silver lining. And so because of that, there is much empowerment of women also because of the conflict, because they had to undergo they were compelled to undergo a hardship, so they have emerged in a different ways in the country. Several coalitions have been formed, right from central to the regional to district to the community level, for various in various sectors relating to women. There are several peace alliances, several organizations working on justice and reconstruction and rebuilding lives. So I think this is one of the major achievements after the conflict and in the transitional period. And credit goes to the international community, which has been ceaselessly supporting the cause of human rights and humanitarian issues, and also specific activities and focus on women and children. However, after the conflict period and during this transition currently, the women's groups, there is some problem. Problem in the sense that there has been ethnic co-optation and there has been political co-optation as well as religious co-optation. So the women's voice as it was so much organized during the conflict period, because of the one single demand of restoring, you know, peace and justice, has been somehow, you know, diverged. I think this is one of the dark side of proliferating of various, you know, groups in the name of, you know, ethnicity and, you know, cultural division, as well as the political division in the country. With regards to addressing the, you know, violence against women, I think Nepal situation cannot be seen in isolation. We share a lot of common issues that other countries in conflict and in transition are encountering. For example, the issues and cases of violence against women, or different forms of violence, have been very much underreported, and in the national court and in probe commissions and others, they have been underrepresented. The primary reason is that women still hesitate to speak because they know that the justice will not be rendered to them. So there is no conducive atmosphere, every single victim, survivor, to come forward and lodge their complaints and grievances to the concerned authorities, because the atmosphere is not conducive enough. So civil society organizations have been coming up with a concerted agenda, and that is to end the cycle of impunity, ensure inclusion in every tiers and every section of the governance, as well as in the non-governmental entities, and they are very much striving for restoring the dignity and establishing their own recognition. These are some of the key issues being shared not only by women's organizations but also by civil society organizations, and particularly led by the human rights group in the country. With regards to the peace agreement, I'd just like to recollect and mention that historical peace deal was concluded in November 2006 between the Communist Party of Nepal, Maoist, and the government. And one of the key components of the comprehensive peace agreement is that there will be a transitional justice mechanism called Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Probably we've been thinking of a replica of South Africa or Peruvian or Moroccans or Sierra Leone type of Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the other major component of the peace agreement is to ensure the inclusion of the marginalized section of the society, particularly the women, and also to ensure non-discrimination while restructuring the state, because that's also one of the major components. Let me also mention briefly about women's participation in the peace process. In the entire peace process, women's participation has been quite negligible. It has been quite minimal. Even within the United Nations system, be it the UNMEN or OSCHR or other agencies, women's participation is not visible. It seems to be quite minimal. And women have been generally understood as the victims or warriors or combatants, but their contribution towards mediation for survival, caring, compassion, and peace building has been severely undermined. So that has not been recognized in the entire peace process. It's not only a question of number of women's representation in different tiers and different system or mechanisms, but it's also embracing the issue of women in the entire process, you know, for rebuilding the lives and for peaceful transition of the country. So we also share the similar experience like in other countries. Women, they do understand the conflict better. They do internalize the conflict better, and they do understand the pain and plights better than anybody else, because they have closely experienced the war. Because the war is not fought really in the battleground, But inside home, in the courtyard, in the paddy field, in the jungle, in the forest, in the streets and the city streets. So they know, they have experienced it, so they know how to deal with this. So that message has not been clearly penetrated in the policy making and decision making level in the country. I think that is the gray area which needs to be hammered, which needs to be hit in the entire intervention by the civil society organization, by the state, and also by the international community. Let me also mention something about impunity. Impunity, the culture of impunity is a major problem, and dealing with the culture of impunity is a Herculean task. Remember, not even a single person or the perpetrators of gender-based violence or disappearance, involuntary disappearance, have been brought to book. I don't know what the proposed Truth and Reconciliation Commission is going to do, but in the past 10 years of time, none of the action has been taken. Rather, the perpetrators have been left totally scot-free. And the proposed, the TRC bill does not have a gender component as such. It doesn't have a clear gender component. It is, I would like to say, it is gender blind. And there is little space or no space for women. We went through the bill. It has not been passed. It has been is still in a draft form. But there has been so much opposition by the civil society organizations, by women's group, by international community, by the United Nations system itself. So it has remained pending. But I don't know whether they're gonna, you know, rewrite the entire draft bill or not, but this is one of the areas where we can really hit, and this is the right time, because women have not been consulted. In the name of, you know, token consultation, the government has organized a couple of regional meetings, but it has really not been the women have really not been brought in confidence in terms of consultation and etc. So there is a mentality that is forget and forgive. The special characteristics of Nepal's peace process and transition is that the one-time giant human rights violators have become the glorious victors, unlike in Peru or any other countries. They were the violators. They were the one who made thousands of people disappear. They're the one who were, you know, very much indulged in gender-based violence, killings, maiming, torture, displacement, whatnot, seizing private properties and everything. But now they have become the victors. So it is very difficult, and it's so challenging, you know, to make the victors as violators and bring them to trial. So the civil society organizations have been forging alliance and taking off this serious challenge of, you know, transitional justice mechanism. And so, again, the credit goes and thanks goes to the international community. So many institutions and organizations have been lending helping hands to Nepal's civil society organizations, you know, to undertake this particular job. So I know my time is running out, so I'll not take more than 30 seconds now. And finally, I also like to share the similar, you know, experience like my previous colleague, is that the post-conflict reparation, post-conflict rebuilding and reconstruction, what I would like to say is that we are so much focusing, you know, to repair the cracked wall and the broken bridge. Everyone is so much interested, you know, to pour money for reconstruction, a physical rebuilding the physical infrastructure. There has been very little attention about mending and repairing the cracked confidence, because there has been a crisis of confidence between the state and the citizens, and particularly the victims and society and families. So this is the high time that support should be rendered to those people whose heart has been broken. So it is more of rebuilding lives with human face rather than physical infrastructure. Of course, we also need to, you know, rebuild or reconstruct the physical or the damaged physical infrastructure. However, two things should go simultaneously. And for that reason, psychosocial intervention is so much important because it's a question of repairing the crisis of confidence of not one or two or hundreds or thousands, but thousands and thousands of people have been suffer because of the conflict. So it's a question of rebuilding the entire society and transforming the entire society for reconciliation. So that is what the civil society organization is engaged in, and women's groups have been coming up with a vigorous, confidence and agenda. And I could also see some of the prominent women's rights activists who are also present in this forum. And we are working collectively together to attain this common goal. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Marie-Claire Ruhamia, we'd like to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to repeat the same ideas my colleague have speak about, but it is the experience of my country, the RDC, so I have the
responsibility. Can you pull the microphone a little closer to you?
I said this, I beg your pardon, because I think I'm going to repeat same ideas my colleague have been before me. But it's the experience, a special experience from RDC. And I tell you to forgive my modest English, because I'm glad to be able to share my message with you online, my modest English. Behalf of the Network of Congolese Women, I would like to thank the Société Institute, and especially our sister and our sister of Women Network of Yanza, for the chance to bring to this important meeting to the voice of women from the Democratic of Congo. I have the responsibility from these Congolese women to inform you about the situation in the east of DRC and to describe the terrible drama that is consuming the whole country. For the past 10 years after genocide in Rwanda, the DRC, especially in the east, has been the scene of the world's most deadly crisis. More than 4 million people have died as a result of armed conflict, violence, displacement, malnutrition, and disease. UN Security Council Resolution 1756 recognizes that a connection between illicit exploitation and trade of natural resources and the traffic of small arms and ammunition in the RDC. Despite this resolution and embargoes on arms to the DRC, despite many peace conferences and the presence of the large peacekeeping mission in the world, we still do not have peace. The years of conflict has had a terrible impact on the life of women in the DRC, particularly at the epicenter of the crisis in the east of Congo, where the conflict had led atrocities of gender based of violence. I belong to an association called SOFEBU, also we tell Solidarity of Women of Buhale. It is a village in the east of Congo. This is association of more than 5,000 women. Many members have been terribly affected and have been subject to rape and other violence. In this situation, it is impossible to work for our living, which puts at risk several of these women and their families. I have seen too many women and girls in sexual slavery who were kidnapped at gunpoint, raped, and suffered genital mutilation. They become human garbage. They have nothing. They are good for nothing. They represent nothing, and they are nothing. Many have fistula obstetrica. The vagina is completely destroyed because of the gang rape by soldiers. The short-term consequence, the women are incontinent. In the long term, if they are pregnant, it is probable that the mother will be died giving birth. Even children on 3 years and grandmother of 75 are among the victims. Women have been put into a state of non-existence. On top of the physical damage from rape, these crimes are not recognized or punished. Women lose their self-esteem. They are silent. They suffer shame and rejected by the husband or community. They have no possibility of social life. The poverty is made worse. They cannot seek justice, even they know who the guilty person is, because the conflict has made a situation of anarchy. The speeches are apocalyptic, and women do not have representation in peace negotiation or in the elected National Assembly and government. But still, women in Congo are acting in synergy. Women's organizations are working at the local level, campaigning for peace and reconciliation, mobilizing and advocating for Security Council Resolution 1325 and for equality in the DRC National Assembly. They have campaigned on TV and radio at the national and international level for democracy and the rule of law. Congolese women make up 53% of the population. We understand that restoration of peace and democracy is necessary for the socio-economic development of our country. But we know that Congolese men will not help us. So the women must help themselves. We must come together in solidarity, raise awareness, and work even more to reach the position where decisions are being made. Our method of work is awareness, raising, mobilization, and participation. The challenge is that every day is also a fight for survival for Congolese women who need to find bread and water for their family. Our slogan in our association, in French we tell, il n'y a pas de paix sans pain, il n'y a pas de pain sans paix. And in English, you can say it, there is no peace without bread and no bread without peace. If you are starving, you cannot fight for peace. We have to feed our family, but we know that without peace, we cannot do that. Our association, SOFEBU, was formed in 1985. From the beginning, our priority was to win the fight against poverty and at the same time to advance the position of women. We work in solidarity for every important activity we have now is finding straws of water. You remember that we must walk a long time to get water every day. Some men also help us, but the women are in charge. It is very important for us. We have reached a situation in our village where women do have power to make decisions. This is the result of our solidarity in our collective work. The same process, the same skill that we have do in development, we hope in our work against poverty, we hope it should extend to the context of peace building and prevention of conflict in our country and in the region. The biggest obstacle to our participation is the war itself. The war damaged so many women so much that they are left unable to think and to act. But Congolese women will fight to be heard. The role of the diaspora is also important. We Congolese women who are outside our country must lobby for women participation to demand that it is become priority and condition for peace and socio-economic development. The RDC government has used some diplomatic process with advice from other countries, but with no result. We believe this is because our government does not have enough political will of its own. For example, they have announced the development of National Action Plan for Resolution 1325, but they had no allocated the financial or human resources necessary to implementation. So we have 8 recommendations. The international community have must take bold action to bring an end to the war. For example, stop supporting rebel groups. You cannot negotiate with them. And the culture of impunity, bring to justice and punish the person guilty of crimes, especially violence against women. Private adequate rehabilitation and integration of victims, and make DDR programs become effective. Stop the sale, traffic, and the use of guns. It is because it is the big problem. And remove the illegal weapons that are already in our communities. Create a monitoring group for the implementation of Resolution 1325. Support, promote women's association and their network in the diaspora. Build relationship of solidarity between ENGO in the north and the south. Make sure that international development and cooperation programs take into account the national and local context with a long-term vision. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. In listening to Dr. Siwakati, I got the impression that in Nepal, the effort to address the problem of violence against women in conflict is very much an issue taken up broadly by the human rights movement and by civil society. But I wonder about Uganda and the DRC. Are the women's groups isolated or marginalized in addressing the issue, or are they well integrated into a broader civil society movement that is concerned with these issues, and is a broader civil society movement pursuing these issues. Perhaps you could begin.
In Uganda, we have very many mainstream human rights organizations that deal with human rights in general. But I must say, the issues of women's human rights are still seen as the business of women's organizations. There is very little that the mainstream human rights organizations do. I'll give you an example. When they go to places like Northern Uganda to document the experiences or to see the violations that are committed, you find that when they come back to report through the media or in parliament, they will kind of generalize the issues. They don't tend to go into the unique experiences of women that need to be highlighted so that we can see the difference in the violations. Of course, the issues of sexuality are those things that men-led human rights organizations don't want to deal with. And I think they come from the patriarchy, you know, socialized the way of living, that you don't talk about those issues. But the women organizations have decided to say, when you can't beat them, join them. And what we've done is that, one, we strategically become members of the mainstream human rights organizations. And when we penetrate through these organizations, we serve on committees. For example, my organization chaired the Human Rights Network for the last 2 years. That way, it becomes easier even to raise awareness of the men. Sometimes, actually, they don't just see what you mean. But at that time, you start making them understand the difference between the violations when you are talking about the men. And in that way, we have seen Human Rights Network, in most cases, when visitors come or donor communities come to Uganda or the Great Lakes region, even Liberia, we've seen them referring these people to our organizations. That is one. The other issue is carrying out activities with them, so that when you carry out, for example, the celebrations of the International Human Rights Day, you get the space to talk about women's concerns. That is the only way I'm seeing it. But to directly come out to talk about women's human rights issues, you hear them always say, oh, you go to FIDA. FIDA is a women's lawyers organization. Or you go to ISIS Wiki. But they never stand up to actually support us and talk about the uniqueness of the violations that women face. Mm-hmm.
You know, you remind me of a way of dealing with sexual violence that I encountered in South Africa, not in a situation of conflict, but South Africa does have a very high level of sexual violence. And I encountered an organization in Alexandra Township in Johannesburg, a women's group which particularly tried to organize men to confront the problem of sexual violence, and was able to organize a number of demonstrations by men against sexual violence. And I had the impression that was an immensely successful effort, that it had a significant role in reducing sexual violence when men in the township became aware that other men were taking part in demonstrations of that sort.
Yeah, and the for South Africa, the issue they brought out was, real men don't beat women. So every man wanted to become a real man. And they kind of now engaged into it, and you know, everybody would put on that t-shirt to show that he's actually a real man and he doesn't violate the women. And it worked. And I think as women organizations, we have also to start realizing that we can't go it ourselves. We really need to find very strategic ways of engaging men to make sure that they kind of support us in a very subtle way. Because if you just go straight to them and say, look, there are violations here, you must deal with them, they go back to their courts. You know, they become real men who just don't want to talk about the violations, especially sexual violence.
Okay. Ms. Rahamia, in the DRC, are the women's groups alone, or do they get significant support from civil society generally?
English. So yes, in FDC, when we have groups of women who work against poverty, it is very important for all population. So the men had to join us and to work with in solidarity with women who are working against poverty. And we were in the group of société civile, civil society. Mm-hmm. And we have men and women who go. But the importance of work of women for against poverty is a very good strategy.
But on the issue of violence particularly, do the civil society groups generally take up the issue?
No, we need we try to work together.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we try in our group women and men only, we can't go on. We have the reality to have good results on long term. We have to work together. So we try, but we have to have strategy to motivate mm-hmm. the men to come with us. So it is very important
and
to work.
And are you succeeding in that?
Or? Yes, we have in my association we success that.
Okay.
But we need possibility and resources to do that. But in case of principle, our strategy is good to motivate
right.
men and women.
Dr. Siwakati, If I'm right in interpreting you as saying that the civil society groups generally have taken up the issue, can you say what the factors were? Why has this succeeded in the case of Nepal?
Thank you. First of all, I would not say that we're 100% successful in achieving or at least addressing the issues relating to violence against women. However, until recently, violence against women was regarded as a kind of intimate form of torture or as a private affair, and to some extent it is still is, particularly in the rural community. However, because of the very strong human rights community's presence, in very much collaboration with women's rights groups. So this is not an issue to be addressed in isolation by women's groups only. This has been the deeply ingrained culture in our society that the issues relating to women or men or children or indigenous community or Dalit have been taken up in a collective fashion. It's I think, bright side of our own culture. And now the civil society groups, of course, with the leadership, frontline leadership of women's organizations, have been, taking off the issue of for the enactment of a bill in the parliament. Of course, it has been, I think, 12 or 13 years. They have been trying hard, but we have still not been successful because of the upheaval in the political situation and change of government, change of parliament, dissolution of parliament, and everything. But we hope we will be successful in the days to come. And also, with regards to the violence against women, particularly in the conflict situation, it is we have been dealing everything in a package as a compact issue. So the alliance which has been formed to establish accountability is a combination of men and women, and also it is also represented by the victims of both sides. So that is a part of the culture. So and also because some of the test cases launched by the civil society groups, of course, again, women's groups in front line have been quite successful, because violence against women is not a crime in isolation. It has something to do with the inheritance right, with citizenship equality and everything. So we have made some groundbreaking sort of success, particularly in terms of citizenship and inheritance right. And also there has been a Supreme Court verdict that even the now marital rape in our country is a crime. So these are some of the collective issues.
I'm going to ask just one more question and then open it up to the floor. And in a sense, this is a question more with respect to Uganda and Nepal than with respect to the DRC, because in the DRC, the conflict is very much a continuing one. But in Uganda and in Nepal, we are more in a post-conflict situation. Right now. And the question is really, when there has been extensive sexual violence in armed conflict, does that carry over into the post-conflict situation? And does that lead to a sort of higher level of sexual violence outside the context of conflict? I'm interested in what the experience is in your countries. Perhaps you could.
Just to say, I'm not yet very sure whether our conflict.
No, I understand. but look, there is a peace agreement.
Yes, it is at least going on, and we are crossing our hands. We hope
right.
It works out. Yes, I think the sexual violence is one that moves on up to the post-conflict time. In the case of Uganda, you find that during the war, actually men completely lose it and everything is left to the women. And by the time we come to post-conflict, you find that women have become very so much empowered that they are actually the ones who are heading homes. Now, what happens is, because of the levels of poverty, and the men having nothing much to do, they get so much involved into that continuous sexual act to keep themselves busy, as one of them told me. Yes. You see, what else can I do? That is the only thing I can do. So you find that they now have this indiscriminate sexual acts with the children, from the age of 3 years to a woman of around 90 years. And it continues on. That is one aspect. Another aspect is the feminization of poverty, whereby because the woman is now the one in charge of the home,
yes,
and there is nothing like an income in her situation, the only thing to do is to sell her body. And she's not selling it because she wants to have sex, but they tell you, do you want me to see my children die of hunger? If this is the only thing I can do to make the children get food, so let it be. And that is how the whole aspect of the HIV/AIDS infection has continued. Other than that, we get what we call camp followers. Soldiers, in most cases, leave their wives in their communities, and they are taken to these places. So when they are there, because they are the only ones who have the money, the food, so you find even sometimes parents telling their daughters to go with the soldiers because they have to access some food. So the sexual violence after the conflict is of three prongs. It's because of the poverty, it's because of the violence, and it is because of the men thinking, to continue to remain a man, I must show my power. And he exerts the power by actually going into defilement, rape. These continue. And with the poor policing, lack of policing anywhere, you find that in one camp there could be only one police post. And of course, if they report, they are told, go and sort it yourselves. So it becomes something that is done with impunity.
Okay. Thank you. Certainly, in the eyes of the general public, the violence against women addressing violence against women in the post-conflict situation is not the issue of top priority. It's not a priority agenda because everyone is aspiring for peace, just peace. And so this has not been really in the public agenda. However, the civil society organizations have been looking into it in a very different lens, through a different lens. So we have been trying to bring that issue in the public domain as well. And so most of the people believe that when there is peace, it is enough because there has been battle fatigue. So really, majority of the people do not want to talk about other things than the peace at this stage, because they want to see the country stabilized, society stabilized. So these are, I think, very like violence against women and other atrocities for the general public are minor issues. However, I think, and that is the reflection also in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission bill, where they didn't speak out or spell out even a single word about the violence against women. And the women's groups themselves have organized and they have reorganized themselves and also formed task force, citizens commission, to deal with this issue. And of course, with the great support from the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, International Commission of Jurists, and others, that now I think the issue of violence against women will be definitely brought in a public domain, and it is going to be one of the most vibrant issues in the entire transitional process.
Ms. Rahamia, although conflict continues in parts of the DRC, in other parts of the DRC, it's really more of a post-conflict situation. And I wonder if you could say anything about the sort of post-conflict areas of the DRC.
I can do difference where today I can do difference of period post-conflict and period post-conflict because we are always in conflict. My sister from Uganda tell you how in some period post-conflict the poverty is so important. So we can see what the difference of during the war and after the war because of poverty. So I think we have to do all we can do against poverty, because with poverty we have war, and because of poverty we can building peace. So but I hope we can, if we our work against the poverty, we can go in the period of our poverty came more important, and so we can have more possibility to try to go in building peace and to convert men and women, surtout les hommes.
Yes. Do you want to go to the microphone? Because I'm now going to open it up, so you're going to get the first. Why don't you go to the... Okay.
Well, Marie-Claire is very modest, and she hasn't explained that she's literally just got off a very long flight to be here. So please bear with her English, because she was very concerned about that. So we have someone here who can translate your question, and so Marie-Claire can speak in French and have it translated into English. That's just my point.
Okay. Don Steinberg?
First of all, thank you very much for the presentations. And in particular, I wanted to thank you for putting women's roles in peace processes and post-conflict reconstruction, not just in the concept of fairness and equity and the victimization of women during the processes, but because what we have found, and I have found through 30 years of working on these issues, is that peace processes are more effective, work better, and are more likely to stick when women are fully involved, both in the negotiation period and in the post-conflict reconstruction period. When you talk about a DDR process, for example, if men indeed are not given roles to play in the societies that they're moving back to, they will resort to domestic violence, they'll resort to rape, drug use. We've seen that in the United States in World War II. We're seeing it right now with people returning from Iraq. When we talk about security sector reform, there's no doubt that women do not come forward to talk about rape with the security forces because in many cases they are the same men who raped them. And unless you have women participating in those processes, it isn't going to work. Transitional justice. If the women of the society essentially believe transitional justice means men with guns forgive other men with guns for crimes committed against women, what participation are women going to have in those processes? And so I guess that would lead to the question, do you find that the efficacy argument works with senior officials in your governments and in the rebel movements? Do they understand that the peace process they're putting together isn't going to be effective without women's participation? And given that there's a substantial role for the international community in each of your peace processes, are you finding that the United Nations, the donor community, and other international bodies are promoting these concepts? Are they actively promoting the involvement of women in the peace processes as well as the post-conflict reconstruction? Thank you.
Ms. O'Cheng, do you want to respond?
That's a very interesting question. And I really thank you for the short analysis you have given. But looking at, I'll give an example of the Juba peace process, which we have really tried to engage government and the LRSI to see the need for the women's peace process. Personally, I feel, I don't think when we are talking, they are even listening. And it makes me start thinking that by the time they come to the peace table, they have not decided by themselves that we are going to the peace table. Most times they are dragged to the peace table. So probably they have not even engaged into what took them to fight. And during the peace process, the discussions at the table, I imagine that they are thinking about how they are going to share what took them to fight. And whatever we are saying as women is just passing them. But I must say, for the case of the Juba Peace Talks donor communities like Norway, the Netherlands, the United States Embassy in Uganda, I think they have really tried to make the government of Uganda see the need. But because of the structures and, you know, this sovereignty kind of terminology we always talk about, they go to a certain step and stop there. And then imagine that the governments have heard, but they are not hearing. So what you see women always do is to try to see whether they can do things which are unbelievable, to see whether these men will get it in their mind. And one time I talked to Rick Marshall myself and said, look, we need some gender analyst to come and specialist to come and make you understand why it is important for women to be at the peace table. And he told me, but UNIFEM is there. Then he said, the Human Rights Commission lady is there. So that's what made me realize that they really don't understand. And that's why in Africa, all these agreements have not worked. Because when they are discussing their own issue of how they are going to share power. Whereas for the women, as I said, we are talking about how do we transform societies so that we can go back and fend for ourselves. So one thing I think you could continue pushing as the international communities is please just get out this issue of sovereign state and just try to tell the fellow.
You happen to be talking to the right person on this issue because he was involved in putting together a new organization called the Responsibility to Protect, which deals with the question of the role of the international community in protecting people who are victims of very severe conflicts.
Supported by the Open Society.
Okay.
Thank you, President. I think now I need to tell him. Because one thing I want to inform you is, one, African governments have known that the international community is taking the issue of sovereignty very serious. Yeah. So they can as well do whatever they are doing and cover under that and say it is a sovereign state. So if you don't want the taxpayers' money of your people to go just like that, I think you need to change your strategies. You can go into a closed door and just tell them. After all, you are contributing more than quite a big percentage of resources to the national budgets. Why can't you stand and just say, we want this and this and this at table? They will, of course, tell you that we don't have enough women to do this. They are wrong. There are very many women who have experience, who will give the realities on the ground, and we can even engage. We don't have to get the Ugandan women. We can pick any woman who has the expert to come and explain to them how it goes. At the moment, I'm very worried. The DDR has already actually, they started it much longer. Government of Uganda said, we are giving iron sheets to only those who would have built a wall to that level. A widow who doesn't have anybody to build. A girl who has come from captivity with a baby, who actually doesn't have any side, who is going to build for her that wall? And she does not have land. African women don't have land. We just stay on men's land. So the issues are complex. And some of us, as the Africans, we have talked so much that they think we are just ringing the bell. That's why we are calling upon the international community to change strategies. You must change strategies, and if it is about also monitoring and seeing what you agreed with the government, do it. Otherwise, your people are going to get tired of giving funds and nothing is happening.
Go ahead. I'm going to ask our other speakers if they want to comment. And then what I'd like to do after that, since there are a number of people at the microphones, I'm going to ask each of them to ask their question and then come back to the panel, and you'll choose which questions you want to respond to or are able to respond to. But go ahead.
Wait. Je voudrais ajouter, Monsieur le Président, je voudrais ajouter, Monsieur le Président, pour soutenir ma sœur de l'Ouganda, que les hommes et les femmes n'ont pas les mêmes objectifs lorsqu'ils sont autour d'une table.
I'd like to add that women and men have not the same objective when they're around around a table of negotiation.
En Afrique, en tout cas au Congo actuellement, depuis plusieurs années, les hommes ont un objectif et nous sommes tristes, nous les femmes, de constater que l'opinion internationale et les conseils internationaux soutiennent cela. Il n'y a que le partage de pouvoir. Les hommes sont autour de la table pour partager le pouvoir et non pas pour construire la société. Les hommes actuellement n'ont pas l'intention de construire la société. Ils veulent partager le pouvoir et c'est très grave.
Well, men want to share power instead of building society, and that's what they're like. Her testimony from DRC.
Et ce qu'on peut demander à l'opinion internationale, en tout cas aux conseillers qui les soutiennent, c'est qu'ils n'aillent pas dans ce sens-là, qu'ils considèrent qu'une société ne se construit pas sur base de pouvoir. Une société se construit sur base de volonté de vivre, de survivre et de faire survivre.
We build a society with survival, life and all this kind of thing, and not power.
Okay. Do you want to comment or?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Briefly. Thank you. One of the key players of the peace process is the Communist Party of Nepal, which is known as CPN Maoist, which started the war in the name of ending discrimination and structural violence. Well, in the three rounds of ceasefire followed by peace talks, they did not send even a single woman. Nowhere. Women were not sent. Whereas almost one third of the total fighters or the guerrillas in the CPN Maoist are women. Now everyone is inside the cantonments now. So it shows the level of mentality that even with the so-called progressive force, they do not or they have not recognized women's roles in the peace process. And when asked by the journalists about why there were not women in the peace negotiation table, and they said, "Yes, we will speak on behalf of them." That has been recorded, and that was said by the supremos of the rebel groups. So it is an irony. It is an irony. And now, even during the constitution making process, in the new interim constitution making process, when initially 9 people were selected and nominated, there was not even a single woman. After the massive pressure by the civil society again and women's groups, a couple of women's names were added for cosmetic flavor. Actually, it's not really as a built-in sort of process. Naturally, and the parliament. The newly reinstated parliament made a historical declaration with the provisions that at least 33% women will be incorporated in the politics and every state mechanisms. And in the National Human Rights Commission, out of 5, there's 1 woman. And I just came to know through my colleagues today is that in the upcoming Constituent Assembly polls, where there are 2,288 candidates, the election is going to take place hopefully on the 10th of April, next month, only 244 women have filed their candidacy. So it is an irony again. So for the international community, including the United Nations Mission in Nepal, it has not really visualized and internalized and implement the true spirit of the UN resolution the Security Council Resolution 1325 in its action and its program. So for the international community, I think it is high time that the any support should be a conditional one. The condition in favor of women, the condition to ensure the women's mandatory representation in all, you know, state mechanism or in every space of life. So it should not be a token reservation, but rather a built-in process in the entire, you know, peace process. Thank you.
Okay. Please.
Thank you. I'm Eleanor Mwadinobi from Nigeria. Thank you very much for your very illuminating presentations. My question is on the post-conflict situation, to find out, in your experience, have you found any situation where the aid agencies have fueled a conflict rather than helped the situation? And secondly, where you have, for example, distribution of whether it's the aid materials or resources, whether women have actually been involved, because this is something that they do every day at household level. Thirdly, I'd like to find out about the availability of treatment for post-traumatic stress, which I know is usually available for the men who have fought the war, but to find out if it is available, for example, for widows who are victims of conflict or for children. Is there any treatment for post-traumatic stress from the conflict situation? Thank you.
Okay, and we're then going to go to other questions and now go to this microphone.
Hi, my name is Sam Cook from the Peace Women Project of Wilts. My question relates to the role of peacekeeping missions, in UN peacekeeping missions, in addressing sexual violence. One of the things that we do at the headquarters level is we're trying to get the Security Council to play a bigger part in addressing sexual violence in conflict. And one of the ways we're trying to do that is to get them to include the issue in the mandates of peacekeeping missions, whether they're new missions or in renewals, and also to consider the issue when they're putting down criteria for drawdown, when they think things are over and they're not. So my question is really one for us to learn from, and that is, if you'd be willing to share any examples of where you think the peacekeeping missions have actually played a positive role in addressing sexual violence, and in what ways you think they could do more, whether it is directly in relation to protection or if it's perhaps in some of the sort of broader areas of security sector reform or economic empowerment. But we'd love your input to see where we can push harder. Thanks.
Okay. Let's take then two more questions and then get responses, and then if we have time, go to the other questioners to this microphone.
Thank you. Thank you very much to all panelists. My name is Violeta Krasnic. I work at Witness. We use video and online technologies to expose human rights abuses. My question is about safety and security for women and sexual violence survivors, and I'll address it to Ruth directly, or Miss Ojumbo, or Jing. I met Ruth 12 years ago and we worked together and haven't seen each other since. As you traveled through villages, as you met women survivors, as you encouraged them to tell their stories, which is the essential first step in highlighting the problem and transforming the society, as you eloquently put it, have you come across at the community level activities or any sorts of engagements which increase safety and security of survivors? Is there anything done at the policy level? And in that regard, what needs to be done in terms of policy to transform this issue as well? Thank you.
Okay, and since I saw people lining up at this microphone first, I'm going to go to the next person in this line.
Thank you. My name is Bandana Rana, and I'm from Nepal, from an organization called SATI that works on violence against women. Thank you very much, all the presenters, for very enriching and informative presentations. I just wanted to share that in Nepal we have very severe post-conflict challenges in the case of women, and if we face similar kind of challenges in other countries as well. And I wouldn't even like it to call post-conflict because it gives a connotation that conflict has ended. But in reality, there are more severe kinds of conflict that has emerged at present. Some of them, like for example, we have faced that there's been an increase in domestic violence after the conflict. You know, the women who have been displaced from conflict-affected areas, particularly young girls, who have actually because fled their households in search of employment because they were vulnerable to either being enforced in the combatant force or sexual exploitation. Now they find it very difficult to return to their home countries, homeland, or the villages because of social stigma, because they've been away for so long. That's another challenge we face. The other challenge we face is, you know, women, like you said, I think, Ruth, women have this traditional role. There are even certain communities in Nepal where they live under a veil and never lift a veil or talk to a man eye to eye. But they've had to survive and talk to men and confront two kinds of, armed forces and survive in that case. So they've been empowered in the process. Probably that's a positive impact. But now that men have returned home, they want the women to go back to the traditional role. And there's a real conflict again, which, again, increases conflict within the community and within the household. There's also, because of access to small arms, there's a lot of crime gangs and criminals. But these crimes are not targeted just to crimes, but also sexual exploitation of women during the night, in the middle of the night. And yes, we have, and you know, we are doing a research in conflict-affected area. It's a pilot research. We haven't finalized the research yet, so I wouldn't like to quote the research. But we found out that contrary to assumptions that sexual exploitation is either by state parties or non-state parties, it's usually the community and the neighborhood and the neighbor men who actually take advantage of the situation. So that's the kind of situation that we have found. And there's no rule of law at the moment, no accountability. And of course, Mr. Shivakoti highlighted that women's participation has been almost negligent in all the processes. So these are real severe challenges that we face at this stage. And I would like to know if there are these kinds of challenges and how you tackle it. Thank you.
Okay. There's a lot now on the table. So let's see if we can try. Do you want to start? Or?
Sure. Aid agencies, are they fueling conflict? I think that was the first question. I would want to say that to answer that question, I wouldn't say they are fueling conflict, but I also want to share this experience where in northern Uganda, we work with quite a number of women community-based organizations. And it came to a time when we had already given them the skills on how to make referrals of, or, you know, women who are stressed and they are suffering trauma. And the first places they went to were some of the international agencies. To our surprise, the women tell us that this agency did not help them. Instead, it looks like the agency is also competing with the women to do the same work on the ground. So it became very difficult for the women to even understand why they were doing that, because they thought this was an agency which would actually refer these women to the Amnesty International, that they need services. To their disappointment, they just pushed them aside and said, oh, we have our own list. So yes, there are some of those who are really, one reason or another, trying to compete with the women who are doing work at the grassroots, and I think that is quite wrong. On the issue of trauma, I want to assure you all over Africa where we have worked, Liberia, Sierra Leone, DRC, Burundi, Rwanda, that is not an issue that governments are really putting any resource into. And we worked with doctors who told us that actually, if you have been in a conflict zone, even if you have not been directly affected, you become a second, you also actually suffer the conflict. And we've been trying to push government of Uganda to see this as an issue. And I must say, Within Uganda, we succeeded, and the Minister of Health put trauma as one of the priorities that they are dealing with. If you go in all the hospitals in Uganda, now there is a referral center in hospitals for trauma. But having said that, it's there on paper, no budget, and nobody cares. So the trauma counseling remains the issue of women. And you find that it is the women who use their traditional ways to see how they can support one another. Some of the traumatic cases are very, you know, they are big, and they really need some professional way of handling. And for those kind of cases, we find very many women, some committing suicide. There are very many suicidal cases in all these conflict-ridden areas. On the issue of peacekeeping missions, well, I know my sister will talk about it. In Uganda, we have not had any peacekeepers because our conflict is one conflict which the rest of the world just wanted to ignore. It is just recently that people started thinking about it. But working in the Great Lakes region, women from Bukavu, Kivu, tell us that actually some of the peacekeepers become violators. In Sudan, we have just documented Southern Sudan, we came across a girl who told us that a peacekeeper was coercing her. She went to look for a job. And he coerced her to say, if you sleep with me, then I'll give you a job. So they are doing the things, quietly, but not that it is really something that is very explosive, but you can't say that they are not. However, in Liberia, that's the one country where we have taken women peacekeepers. And we found out
there's
that
one complete force of women peacekeepers.
Yes.
From which country is it again?
Bangladesh
India, sent an entire company of women peacekeepers in Liberia.
Yes, and talking with the women organizations in Liberia, they tell us that they have done some, at least there is something they are doing. If there is a violation, they really report it and follow it up. Probably this is the time for peacekeepers to be women, because they are not going to go into these sexual violences, I would imagine. Safety and security of the women we have worked with in conflict-ridden areas. In all the areas we have worked in as ISIS Wiki, I don't see any government that has taken that as its responsibility of giving the women who have talked about their experiences, even identifying people who have violated them. Mm-hmm. Nobody gives them safety, nobody gives them security. And that's why women don't want to come out to talk about who has violated them. But they tell us, and we know who these people are. But because we cannot also give them the safety after the case has been taken to court, we are also challenged on how to handle the case. Those girls who have come out of the bush, the safety is in the community-based organization women's groups. Mm-hmm. They are the ones who are struggling with these women. They are the ones who are trying to give them self-help, support. They are the ones who are giving them the skills to start mm-hmm. doing something little mm-hmm. with no money, mm-hmm. and sometimes getting from their own pockets.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. I'll try to be as brief as possible. Firstly, the role of aid agencies. I do not think in our cases that it is contributing to fuel the conflict. But however, a better coordination is definitely required in order to, reach adequately and sufficiently and properly reach to the, target community in terms of relief and humanitarian aid. And with regards to the post-traumatic stress, as I also mentioned earlier, that this is one of the issues that has received the least attention, because everyone seems to be more interested in infrastructure building and rebuilding and renovation. However, the renovation of your broken heart is not in the in the priority. But some of the NGOs are really working on torture as well as post-conflict trauma. So basically, a state doesn't have any program, any institutionalized program as such. However, NGOs, some of the NGOs do have, but which is not sufficient enough to cover the entire victims or survivors and families and relatives. Secondly, with regards to the United Nations mission, in Nepal is called UNMIN. The UNMIN's mission, it has a limited mandate. It is, please note that it is not a blue helmet operation in Nepal. It is a political mission. So the scope and mandate is limited to only arms management. In Nepal, we do not use the terminology DDR. Rather, we use arms management only. So there is no formal DDR process as such in Nepal. I think this is a peculiar sort of situation, even after a decade-long high-voltage inter-armed conflict and the suffering, but still we do not call it DDR. Safety and security of women, we still have absence of the Witness and Victims Protection Act. So people, particularly the victims and survivors, are not really, in a position to open up themselves, to narrate their stories. It also depends on how the political situation grows, because the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been designed, or at least the draft bill has been designed for a total amnesty. So there is a lot of suspicion around whether, like, the people will be really be able to, express their stories in a free, frank, and open manner, because of the nature and because of the mentality of forget and forgive in the ruling coalitions. So, and that is one important thing, and there's no any policy as such in terms of victims protection. Finally, with regards to the post-conflict situation concerning gender-based violence, in our context, I think there is a further need to undertake research. My colleagues have been working in a particular districts where they have found typical examples of the post-conflict violence, gender-based violence, etc. I think that sort of research needs to be expanded so that we'll have a clear, total reflection of the entire nation. Thank you.
Okay. I'm mindful that there are two people waiting patiently at the microphone, and at the same time, I want to end as close to on time as possible. So please go forward, but I don't want to cut things off so that as to exclude the two people who are waiting at the microphone. Okay?
Très rapidement, Monsieur le Président, merci. Pour ce qui est des traumatismes, des conflits, c'est justement les femmes, comme l'a dit ma sœur, qui, jusqu'à présent, ont se charge seules d'essayer de gérer les traumatismes. Parce que le programme DDR au Congo n'est pas efficace. Ça va, ça?
So in DRC, women are the only one in charge of traumatism treatments, and they because DDR programs are not efficient.
Quant à la mission de l'ONU, je suis très gênée de vous dire que Congo n'a pas confiance à la mission.
also in DRC they are not confident in the mission, the UN mission.
Il y a même des cas et des endroits où eux-mêmes ont été impliqués dans les violences envers les femmes et les enfants.
So there are parts in DRC where the mission soldiers were involved in violence against women.
Et donc la population pour le moment voudrait que la mission quitte le Congo et c'est très grave.
So now the population in DRC would like the mission to leave DRC.
You want
Alors,
them to leave?
To leave, to go.
Okay.
Okay. La troisième question c'était quoi? Mais nous avons quand même espoir. Nous ne sommes pas très pessimistes, Monsieur le Président, parce que nous connaissons la force des femmes. C'est pour ça que nous espérons qu'on peut aider les femmes à montrer de quoi elles sont capables.
Well, they are hoping that they can show that what women are able to. So it's not completely pessimistic.
Then. Okay. If we can have the two questions then.
Okay. Thank you very much. My name is Obi Mwankwan from Nigeria. Very briefly, my question is for my sister from Uganda and from the DRC. I just want to know what the women's groups in Uganda and DRC think about the presence of the International Criminal Court in these two situation countries. You know that the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court makes very wide and protective positions for women, and actually is the first document that has declared sexual violence as a crime against humanity. Now in Uganda, we know about the peace process, the peace agreement, but what are the women doing? Because there cannot be peace if we don't end impunity. And that is what the Rome Statute is trying to do. So for us to end impunity, those who are found guilty of sexual violence should be brought to book. This is what the Rome Statute is all about. So what do the women of Uganda and DRC think about it? And what are you doing to ensure that these people are brought to book? For DRC, there have been two arrests, trial is on, but what is going on? Are we supporting, as women, supporting the process? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll try to be brief. I'm Laurie Shestack Phipps from the U.S. mission to the UN. And Marie-Claire, you mentioned the need to have a monitoring group for Security Council Resolution 1325. And Ruth, you mentioned the difficulties in getting people to speak up about the violations that have happened to them. If there were to be a monitoring group set up by the Security Council, it's relatively easy to quantify how many women peacekeepers there are. There are too few, but it can be quantified. It's relatively easy to quantify how many women are at peace tables. Too few, but it can be quantified. But what can be done to quantify the victims of violence in these conflict situations? How can the UN, the Secretariat, the Security Council be effective and efficient in trying to compile statistics and do meaningful monitoring of how many women are victimized? Because we hear so many horrible anecdotal reports, but the UN wants to work on the basis of facts, not just anecdotes. So I'm asking for your thoughts on how a monitoring mechanism might be made to work. Thank you.
Okay. Two questions, one dealing with the prosecutions under the Rome Statute, the Treaty for the International Criminal Court, and the other on the quantification of the violence. So, you want to, again, why don't you start?
The ICC, what have we done? First of all, I think I want to say the women of Uganda feel that the way the ICC was introduced to the case of Uganda was the wrong way. We woke up one day and heard on BBC that the ICC was coming to Uganda. That caused a lot of suspicions, and it was between Mr. Ocampo met with the President Museveni, and then we had the ICC was coming to Uganda. So because of that, there were a lot of suspicions. Why is it that the ICC is coming without even explaining to us what the ICC is? That was one problem. Secondly, the survivors felt wasted when they realized that the ICC was going to, of course, to start in 2002, when for them they know of atrocities that were committed to them by the government soldiers before 2002. So when it came with that kind of connotations and with no information, no facts about it, nobody came to raise awareness of to the people what it entails and how they will be protected. It has been a very tight rope to jump. As women who are elite, we feel that yes, the ICC should really go up and commit these people who did the atrocities. But we are also challenged by the survivors to say the ICC is going to commit only 5. Now we have, in Uganda case, we have only 3. And the women say, the people you are talking about never violated me. I have not even seen them. But I know those who committed atrocities against me. So it is, and then when you come to northern Uganda, they want to use their own traditional mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And these mechanisms are not really going to be very proactive to women to see justice, because unless they are reformed, they are really against women, because they won't even talk about the sexual violence that the traditional mechanism is talking about killings. So what we did as the women's movement in Uganda, when we saw the International Criminal Court coming in and out of Uganda without even consulting the women, we linked up with the Women Initiative for Gender Justice at The Hague and said, look, the women's stories are not going to the court. But then we hear that those who came in had said women don't want to talk about their case, which was wrong, because when the Women Initiative came in, we were able to talk to the women. Mm-hmm. The reason why we are not very excited about the ICC is the protection of these women. When they tell the story, I'll give you a scenario. In Europe here, you are living in flats, and maybe the police can protect that person. But look at this village, which is hundreds of kilometers away from where civilization is. And then the woman comes and says, this gentleman killed my son. And probably he's committed and taken to prison. They go back to their villages. Of course, there will be revenge. Mm-hmm. There's going to be revenge, and there will be nobody who is going to actually stop that revenge to happen. So we were asking the International Criminal Court, give us the mechanism you are going to make these women safe. We haven't seen that, but we are calling for it. So if the ICC can give the protection, if the ICC can actually say after the commitment there is going to be psychosocial rehabilitation of individuals, because these individuals are looking for that, then it is going to bring more women to come out and say. But having said that, you must also know that there are women who have never told their husbands that they were raped. Because they are not working, they are being supported by the men, I would rather keep quiet. So it is complex, and it requires a lot of sensitization and a lot of protection. On the issue of...
We're now about 10 minutes beyond the time that we said we would end. So any further comments should be very brief, okay?
Maybe I'll give my colleagues.
Okay. Ms. Rahamia, do you want to respond?
Je voulais dire pour la Cour pénale si on a confiance à la Cour pénale. Je suis mitigée. À la fois, on a confiance parce que quand on arrête un type là-bas, comme Lubanga, ça donne un peu confiance aux femmes. Et ça aide à espérer. Mais nous savons que le plus grand criminel ou à cette cour, pardonnez-moi de ce que je vais dire. Pour le moment, les gens disent pourquoi il n'y a que des Noirs qui se font juger là-bas. Ça veut dire que c'est un jeu. Ça veut dire qu'on n'arrive pas à punir comme il faut. Mais ça donne espoir quand même. Alors, oui.
So she was saying that when someone is arrested, when someone is arrested, like
Thomas Lubanga,
it creates hope for women. But
he is the first person who is being tried before the International Criminal Court. That is, he was arrested in the DRC and turned over to the ICC.
Yeah, but on the other hand, women are wondering why only black people are judged into these courts. So, is it fair?
Okay. Alors, pour ce qui est du monitoring, madame, nous pensons que les associations, justement, chez nous, les femmes savent, peuvent parler entre associations des criminels. Mais, quelque part, étant donné les désordres du fonctionnement du pays, on ne peut pas aller plus haut pour accuser. Et donc, il faut nous aider, nous les femmes, à pouvoir maîtriser, ou en tout cas imposer le système de justice à nos pays. Et c'est possible avec nos associations, si nous avons les aides nécessaires.
So she says that between association, women's association, between women's association, it's possible, it's possible to talk about these criminals, but it's not possible to talk about it higher in the justice system, I think. So they would like help to be able to go to this
system. Notamment en occupant des postes de pouvoir, et c'est possible aussi.
Let me just say that the International Criminal Court is a big subject. I can assure you we will have forums here solely devoted to that issue. I don't think we're going to be able to, in the few seconds we have left, be able to resolve some of the issues related to the ICC. So, one sentence, okay.
I think on the issue of statistics, there is a lot of information that women organizations have collected. What I would appeal to the UN to do is push money into the data collection. You'll get the data.
Yes.
We don't have money to collect this data. We do it with the little money we have. But if you push the money into there, there is a lot of information that you'll get.
Yeah. And there is a very good study of the violence in northern Uganda, which was done by a number of research institutions, including the Berkeley Human Rights Center, which interviewed large numbers of victims of the violence and gathered information on what their interests are. And so there is quite a lot of information available. I'm going to thank the panel for the comments this evening, which I thought were very significant, and I'm grateful to each of you. I'm also grateful to the members of the audience, and especially those who took part in the discussion by asking questions. And the final moments of this forum, I'm going to turn over to Mariam Elahi, who is the director of the International Women's Program at the Open Society Institute. Mariam?
Thank you very much. I just wanted to take a moment to express our deep gratitude to our distinguished panelists for being the voices from the ground to be able to really give us a sense of the issues. We are committed to being your partners, to working together to follow through on addressing the issues of impunity and justice and equal dignity for women and men in all the countries that we work on. And as you know, your three countries are the countries that the International Women's Program has prioritized, so we look forward to being partners. And I'd also like to thank our president, Mr. Nair, for moderating and sharing today's event. I'd like to invite our audience to look at our website and look at upcoming events, because we're going to continue having a number of events that address the issues of women in conflict and post-conflict societies, and we would very much welcome your participation.
And since there are some refreshments still left, you're welcome to help yourself. Thank you.